The views expressed on the following show may not be those of the hosts, guests, or WSPN Skidmore Radio. Talk Saratoga is produced by Saratoga Broadcasting Incorporated and may not be reproduced in part or in whole unless expressed written approval is given. Now, here are the hosts of Talk Saratoga, Rick Thompson and a Saratoga All-Star.
Okay, I'm your host, Rick Thompson, this morning for Talk Saratoga. And with us, we have a special guest. Special because he knows me. But his name is Mark Pollock. And just give you a little history of Mark. Mark and I grew up together in Gloversville, New York, and lived around the corner from each other. Mark went to an elementary Catholic school that was about five blocks away from the Catholic elementary school that I went to. We both went to Catholic high school together. I only went 2 years and went to the public school, Gloversville High, and Mark stayed and graduated from Bishop Burke. Mark went on to an illustrious fire department career, and I gallivanted around in my jobs through my life. I hadn't seen Mark in probably 35 years until I started working up at the track about 7 years ago. And I looked to my right, and there was this fellow that looked familiar. And it ended up being Mark. And I think that first year, no, we did nothing but talk about people we went to school with. And he ended up moving up to Boston Spa. And so now we get together once or twice a week for coffee, and I'm glad he's up here because somebody from the old neighborhood is here, and we usually talk about things that went on growing up and back in the fine city of Gloversville. So good morning, Mark.
Morning, Rick.
How you doing?
Okay, good.
Did I bring that to a full ending
yeah,
there?
I guess so.
I mean, we talk about Gloversville all the time and growing up and, what a nice city it was. And
yeah, the good old days.
The good old days and how much we really enjoyed the city and kind of wish it was like that now because it was really beautiful, a lot of things to do. Had a couple industries. One was the leather industry, which was the bulk of it. And I'll let Mark get into a little bit of the history of Fulton County.
I was involved with the Fulton County Museum for a number of years. I was president probably the last 4 or 5 years. I resigned in 2017. And for those who have never been to the Fulton County Museum, it's a short 40-minute ride from Saratoga. Just go west on 29. And the museum this year, it's dedicated to the Year of the Glove, and we have a lot of different events. I'll go through some of them. If you want the real details, I would go to their websites, FultonCountyMuseum.com.
I just want to tell you, my daughter last night, she comes over every Friday for dinner, and she wanted me to make this statement, so I'm going to glove it or make war.
Wow.
Instead of love it and make war,
okay.
Glove it and make war. She goes, get it, Dad? I said, yeah, I do, yeah, Sarah, yeah. Unfortunately.
To kick off the Year of the Glove, this March 28th at 6:30 p.m. at the Fulton County Museum, I'll get into the address and location afterwards. It's kind of an interesting thing. They have some artwork that was done by students in Perth, Scotland. And there's a connection between Perth, Scotland and the Fulton County glove industry. And these students have done some artwork, and it's going to be displayed at the museum. There's also going to be provided adult refreshments, sourced beer, cider, and cheese. The details are on their webpage, once again, FultonCountyMuseum.com. And that's kind of the kickoff, and there will be different tributes to the glove industry all the way till October.
Just to get and I know you've got some things to bring up here, but what are some of the things about items in the museum that has to do with Fulton County?
Well, we have a large number of rooms. It's, for those who haven't been there, it's a former elementary school built in the 1800s. It's a rather large building. Some of the exhibits, I'll run through them real quick. We have the Fulton County Baseball and Sports Hall of Fame, which is local memorabilia from different baseball teams, semi-pro teams that were in Amsterdam, Gloversville, and Johnstown area. We have a military room that has artifacts from the 1700s all the way up to the current military. It includes many different uniforms, firearms, swords, and et cetera. We have a public service detailing the fire departments and the sheriff department. We actually have a jail cell that was removed from the old county jail. We also have the hanging gallows that was used to hang a number of people back in the day. We have a Iroquois longhouse replica giving tribute to the Native Americans. And of course, we have the leather tanning and glove making rooms. We have dedicated room to the railroad, the local railroad. We have a technology room, which is old radios, TVs, cameras. A farm and tool room. Business, local business, commercial ads, street signs, hotel artifacts, photographs. And we also have a Victorian room with Victorian dress and furnishings. And we also have a large quilt collection for those who... There seems to be quite a following of quilt people. I am not one, but we do have a lot of quilts.
Yeah, I think the even up here in the Boston Spa Museum, which isn't that big, has quilts in it. I think quilting was probably a big thing back in the day because they didn't have it much to do.
There is a quilt trail, actually, and in front of the museum, there's a quilt pattern that was made, and it's, you know, it's on wood, it's painted, and apparently there's a quilt trail that you can follow and go to different places and see different quilts. I have not done this.
You have not done that.
And probably never will.
And probably never will. That's right. Let's get quilted. Now, what do you add to the museum every so often? I mean, you add some...
Well, they have a... every year they have a changing exhibit in the big meeting room. I think last two years was dedicated to the Little League Park, Parker's Field, which I believe is in Gloversville, but I believe it's the oldest continuous use baseball field in the United States.
Yeah, we had Dave Karpinski on one time, and the program was dedicated to Parker's Field, and you don't stop to think about it. Of course, I'm not that familiar with Saratoga history, although we're going to get the Saratoga historian on sometime to talk about Saratoga and the Wiltons historian on. But the people that came through our area down there when the railroads were going, you know, the trains were going through, I mean, you had Ty Cobb, you had Christy Mathewson. You had a lot of the old-time baseball players play pickup games.
Well, I believe the field was actually owned by the railroad, the local railroad, the FJ&G, Fonda Johnson, Gloversville Railroad. And what they would do, especially during spring training, teams going from, like, say, Boston area to Chicago, they would stop and play an exhibition game in Gloversville at the Parker's Field.
That's pretty neat.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you look at downtown Saratoga, of course, it's a lot livelier than downtown Gloversville, although Gloversville was once the city to go to rather than Saratoga, except in August. During a radio show and the other radio show we had down on in Malta on the radio station, people used to call in and... the show back then was called the Senior Forum, and they used to say they went to Gloversville Friday, Saturday nights for the dances, right, and out to dinner. And so that area was very popular back in the 30s and 40s and probably even 50s.
Right. I had an uncle who was from originally from Schenectady, and you know, they would make the trek on a Friday night to go to Gloversville and the numerous grills, bars, and
But it's funny how you take one industry away and you just, you know, can go downhill so fast.
Oh, absolutely,
you
know? Absolutely.
We talked the other day, which was interesting, about the, and we'll get back to more of the museum, but the veering off is part of the program to take off on some subjects, but you know a little bit about the glove industry because you said your grandfather was a cutter, and I'm most interested in that end of the business because back when your grandfather worked there, probably had to be, what, in the 40s,
50s? Probably right up into the 50s.
Okay, and they were well-paid people,
oh, absolutely,
the cutters, and they didn't cut gloves by hand. They had these dies. Right, razor-sharp dies that they would place on the leather and then hit it with a bigger hammer.
Right.
And that would cut out the form of the glove. Now, what was the most important part of a cutter?
Well, you had every hide, a piece of leather, was valuable. And the less scraps you had, you know, the better it was. It was more money for the employer. So it was a glove, the table cutter's job to get as many gloves out of that piece of leather. And it was a very complicated thing. They actually had something that looked like a butter knife, and they would rub it on the leather just to see which way the grain was going. And it was very complicated. And to be glove cutter, you had to either have a father who was one, a grandfather who was one, and it was a 7-year apprenticeship. And, you know, they went to work with ties and a vest. I always saw my grandfather with a tie and a vest. I don't think I ever saw him without one.
Yeah, when I see pictures of cutters, they're always well-dressed.
Yeah,
that was
the upper echelon.
Upper echelon of the glove making, because you wouldn't want to wear a suit or tie and good clothes when you were tanning the skins or anything.
Well, yeah, my other grandfather was on the opposite end. He was he worked in the beam shop, which is the first stop for skins coming into the tannery, and it was really an awful place, and some mills actually had a separate building, a beam shop, and that's where they would scrape the flesh off the skins and all the hair. And it was just a nasty, nasty job.
Oh, yeah. And I think that was going on right up until the closing of the mills. But I do have to say that my brother worked in the mills because he had his wife's uncle ran one of the mills for what was a conglomerate down there, Carg Brothers.
Oh, absolutely.
They owned several.
Probably the biggest.
And he was the one that wore rubber gloves up to his shoulders,
right,
and had to dip the skins in this chemical that you could take the hair off. He made fantastic money. I mean, he made enough money to pay for his college tuition and room and board, mm-hmm, in just 8 weeks in the summertime. So the leather industry, along with GE and Schenectady, was the largest industry around, and really had a reputation for its gloves.
There were other places in the United States who probably made more gloves, larger output, but they were more like work gloves. Fulton County, Montgomery County, they were noted for their finer gloves, fine women's gloves. And, you know, the quality gloves.
Right. Plus, I think they also had contract for the Army
or
the services, military.
Yeah, yeah, there was some, I don't know if you remember, back in the 70s, there was some
shenanigans and the bidding for the contracts.
A couple of the owners actually went to jail for that.
Really?
Bid rigging, yeah.
Well, I remember that quite vividly because they used to bid on the government contracts, right. And I think they used to make deals with each other.
Right, one would win the contract one year, and then the other one would win it the next year.
Yeah. It's funny how...
That's the way it was.
That's the way it was. And I'm sure that's the way it was in a lot of industries,
still is,
you know.
Probably.
But I then went... then when the leather industry started going down, I think it was because of the government taxes that was imposed on the leather industries,
well,
wasn't
the tanning,
it?
A lot of it was the EPA... I mean, I'm sure you can remember the stream, the Cadetta Creek would change colors depending on what color the mill was tanning that day. And then, you know, they finally stepped in and they started making the tanneries pre-treat everything before it went into the sewer system. And, you know, it was just cost prohibitive. It was easier to send the leather to a third world country.
Right, they sent them down the island, Puerto Rico.
Oh, well, they sent them to Mexico, too.
Mexico, yeah. It's just interesting to follow the track of the leather industry. And one thing that a lot of people may not realize, may not even know them, but Samuel Goldwyn, mm-hmm. from the Goldwyn, whatever it was, Mayor Goldwyn...
Metro Goldwyn-Myers.
Yeah, the big movie producer, came to the country, and back then when you came to New York, there would be jobbers out around the shipyard, and these kids would get off the boat, and they'd say, do you want a job? Mm-hmm. And they shipped him up to Gloversville, to work in the leather mills, and he did. Then he became a salesman, and he always wanted to stay at the Kingsborough Hotel, which was the fancy hotel back then. But, of course, he didn't make enough or wasn't well enough, off. And he became a big salesman and went to New York and met a guy named Otto Preminger. And he said, come on, Sam, let's go make movies. Of course, Sam's name last name wasn't Goldwyn. It was probably Glodowski or whatever.
Fishburne or something. Something like that.
Yeah. Well, but anyway, then he went out. They moved out to California in the early days, and he ended up becoming a pretty big producer in that.
Mogul.
Yeah. But I remember at the. Do you know about the Glove Theater? How they used to have a lot of the movie premieres there because
right.
The Shines owned probably 80% right. of the movie theaters in the United States.
Yeah, Drums Along the Mohawk was actually an older movie with Henry Fonda that was actually premiered both in Gloversville and Amsterdam.
Oh, really?
Right.
Well, that's interesting,
we
too.
We have some pictures of that, of the marquee and such.
Really? Now, above the Glove Theater, there you said that there was a big hall up there, correct?
Right. Well, it's next to the Glove Theater was the, now it's called the Shine Memorial Hall, but it was actually started out as the Casson Opera House, 1881. It had like 1,400 seats. It was, I'm not sure when it closed up, but later the ground floor was turned into... storefronts, the second and third floor, were turned into businesses. It had a rough life, and recently, probably in the last 10, 15 years, a group has taken over the building, and there is actually one of the events this year, with the Year of the Glove. On the third floor, there's a gallery, and once again, if you go to the website, it's going to be in April, so it's actually a lot much better to go to our web page and you'll get the times and dates and everything. But it's going to be a presentation of leather art, baskets, vintage basket quilts from the Fulton County Museum, and all kinds of different things. And it's free to get in. The donations are going to be given to the Fulton County Museum this year. It's on the third floor, and there is a modern elevator. It's not one from the 1800s. So, once again, if you go to our webpage, there's full information on the location, times, and dates.
Yeah, I mean, Usually today, anytime you want to find out information about anything, you go on the web, you know.
Yeah, you know I'm not a Facebook person. That's why I'm still helping them maintain the web page, because my first thing is to go to a web page rather than the Facebook. But they are on Facebook also.
Yeah, I don't think you can quite get the information you can on Facebook.
And there's a lot of links, too, at the Fulton County. If you go to their links page, there's all kinds of links to different leather sites and other things in Fulton County.
Yeah. I'm going to veer off a little bit, and I don't know if you have information about, and we'll get back to the museum in a bit. I wanted to talk a little bit about Sir William Johnson. I don't know if you have anything at the museum.
Not very much. I think we have a portrait.
Okay, that's about it.
And it's not a very good portrait.
Well, he played a big part in the development of Montgomery County and Fulton County back in the early to mid-1700s.
It was actually, during his time, I think it was actually Tryon County.
Tryon County.
It was separated into Fulton and Montgomery.
Okay. And he got quite a bit of property in Montgomery County. Matter of fact, they built a manor. If you go from Amsterdam to Fonda on the right-hand side, there's a big manor that was his when he was dealing. He had a contract to sell goods, I think, and he was on one side. His son was on the other side of the Mohawk River, and they sold a lot of supplies.
Yeah, there's several houses on Route 5. That belong to the family, one way or the other.
I'm trying to see here, because people would be, I love history from back in that period. But a fellow by the name of Peter Warren owned a large tract of undeveloped land on the south side of the Mohawk River, and it ended up becoming Warrensburg. But it was implied that when Johnson arrived with 12 Irish Protestant families, because he was Irish himself, he began to clear the land, and he purchased African slaves to do the heavy labor of clearance. But they were the first of many brought to this part of the country, because slaves mostly were down south. But this was so early in our history that there were only 13 states, you know. But Warren intended Johnson to become involved with trading with the American Indians, but he soon realized the trade routes were to the north. And basically, that's all this area was a trade route, because all the areas along the rivers were the most populated, either along the Hudson or the Mohawk, because that's where they got their water from. I mean, if you lived up here, unless you took a trek up to Lake George, I mean, you know, you couldn't live, really. But Johnson was, I think, an amazing person. Of course, with every amazing person's come some tall tales, but he did align himself with the Indian tribes. I guess it's called the Six Nations.
Right, the Iroquois.
The Iroquois. The Confederation. And, Confederation and the Mohawk Indians.
Well, they were part of the, I think.
They were part of the Confederation.
I believe.
Yeah, they were. They were part of the Confederation. I did some research on Johnson last night, because my wife had given me a book on the life of Sir William Johnson about 10 years ago, and now she put it somewhere and couldn't remember where she put it. And so anyway, she swears she can't even remember buying it for me, but I remember reading about it. But one of the things that that he could do with between the Europeans and then the Indians was that he became one of the Indians. They trusted him, and when he used to go to their tribes, he would dress in Indian garb, and they thought a lot of him, that if an Englishman could dress like one of them to give him honor at their powwows or whatever, that so he ended up becoming really good friends with the Indian tribes and had a big part to play in this area during the French and Indian Wars. Because
and there's also a tie-in with the spring on High Rock, I believe.
Yeah, High Rock Spring. He was wounded in the French-Indian War up north because they took over a couple of forts from the French up there and their Indian counterparts, and he got shot in the leg, I think it was. And back then, if you got shot, you were pretty much destined to die at some point.
Right.
They used lead balls and
gangrene
would set in soon. So the Indians used to use High Rock Springs quite a bit for their own personal benefit. And he was wounded, and the Indians brought him down here to High Rock, and I think he spent a year here, but he recovered.
Mm-hmm.
And which was pretty interesting. And then he went back to Johnstown. Well, they had Tryon or whatever it was called back then, but I think it was like Johnsville or something like that.
Yeah, I'm not sure about that.
But they named Johnstown after
Sir
William, and he built this Episcopal church
in
Johnstown.
It's still there and still being used.
Still there, still being used, and he's buried under the church.
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah. Of course, that's what they said, but you never, I don't know if anybody's going to dig him up, but...
Yeah, no.
But he owned probably, what I found very interesting, and we'll get into his marriage soon, but he ended up owning about, 80,000 acres of property that the king gave him between Amsterdam and Fonda, plus almost as far as you could see from Johnstown now, west and into the, I think, into the Mohawk Valley. And he owned quite a bit. So then he built the Johnson Manor on a tract of land in Johnstown. It's still standing today.
Yep.
You can take a tour through it, and it's very interesting.
The state
took it over as a historic site. And that's where the Indians used to come. And what impressed me was, and I always wondered, you know, the first time I went there, when you walk in the front door, there's a huge room, huge, with all these stools and heaters in there. Well, that's where the Indians used to go in and sit, and then to have an audience with them to ask for whatever they wanted. And he would call them in one by one or some aide. So the Indians were really... depended on him for a lot of their living needs. And but one of the things about now, I want to just talk a little bit about Johnson's family and his marriages, which was kind of, back then it was kind of a little crazy. I mean, in his lifetime, he gained a reputation as a man who had numerous children with several European and Native American women.
Right, he was a womanizer.
He was a womanizer, but he ended up marrying... it says here that one historian, Francis Jennings, estimated that he had 100 illegitimate children. So, you know what? The guy was a player back then. What are you going to do? But I think he ended up marrying a Mohawk chief's daughter, correct?
Right, and there was a Joseph Brant.
Joseph Brant. I think he Englished his name because I forgot what his Indian name was. It's so long, I can't pronounce it. But
he was a Tory. He sided with the British, and he led a lot of raids through the Mohawk Valley and was, very butcher.
Oh yeah, he was
but
very
then later
bad.
Later on, he became, more European and.
Then Mohawk.
And ended up, almost being a gentleman.
A
European gentleman.
Yeah, no, that's right. And I think that's when he changed his name to Joseph Brant, because he was the Indian chief back then. But Johnson, knowing that that Brent was powerful and could be a good ally, married his daughter, Molly Brent. Mm-hmm. And together they had, I don't know how many children, but they had a long-term relationship. And, you know, that, and that added to his reputation as an Indian agent. And but one of the things that I found interesting was that he was always out to get more for himself, whether it be property or allies, because he fought in so many wars, because I think he was a Tory himself.
Well, he probably would have been. He died before the Revolution.
Before the Revolution.
There was always a big discussion whether he would have stayed loyal to the...
to the
son
crown.
Stayed loyal to the king. And
right.
That's a whole another chapter.
Right. But I know that the Americans confiscated all his property. And
yeah.
He owned, like I said...
Along
you know,
with the Mohawks' property, too.
Right, with the Mohawks' property, because they were so closely allied. But I think, was Joseph Brant involved in the burning of the Mohawk Valley?
I think that would have been his son. I think
his
that was,
son?
That was later. Now, he was dead at the time of the Revolution.
Okay.
So it had to be the son.
Okay, go ahead.
They were exiled to Canada, and it had to be the son who did the raids. We had a speaker at the museum on time and talked about the son and his wife, and he had a mistress, and the mistress was always looked down upon. And later on, after the war, the son and his family moved to Canada along with the Mohawk Indians, and the mistress actually married somebody famous, and she's buried in a huge tomb somewhere in Schenectady, where the Johnson family up in Canada, their tombs were just bulldozed to make building lots or something. So it was kind of a turnaround event. So.
Sure. Well, you know, in researching Johnson, it says during the American Revolution, the rebel New York legislature seized all of Johnson's lands and property, as the Zeros were loyalists.
Right.
And the American or the New York legislature still is operates the same way as it did back then. The I always say, as you do, the New York and Saratoga, especially saying is, you agree, what is it, we all agree?
Yeah, everybody's welcome as long as you agree with us.
That's right, everybody's welcome as long as you agree with us. And I think that's why a lot of people are leaving New York now. But that was an awful lot of property that was taken back, because he owned quite a bit in Fulton, Montgomery.
Well, an interesting thing, after Hurricane Sandy, a lot of foundations were that they didn't know about were uncovered down in Montgomery County, and what they found out was that the Mohawk Indians were living as Europeans. They were living in houses, not the longhouses.
Oh,
they
really?
Found pottery and jewelry in these foundations, which led them to believe that at that time they had become European.
Now, is that due to Sir William Johnson's influence on them?
I would have to assume, yeah.
Right.
The Johnson family pretty much ruled the Mohawk Valley and vicinity.
And that's interesting because, I mean, as far up as Albany and Schenectady, it was settled by the Dutch.
Right.
And they used Indians, too, for their purposes. But I know the trade route went from Albany up through... probably where the Northway is now, came up to go to Montreal. Mm-hmm. You had to go through Canada. And it was funny reading that the reason he built all these houses down in the Mohawk Valley is because when he went from like Warrensburg to another town, I mean, you couldn't get there overnight. So he
right.
would stay in one of his houses, and then he would go to another one the next day and work his way up to the manor he built in Johnstown. And
well, that's the way it was back then. A village of Northville up on the Sacandaga,
mm-hmm.
They used to have a lot of hotels, and the reason being that was as far as you would get from if you were going by stagecoach from Albany.
Oh, really?
So that would be as far as you could get would be Northville. So they had to have a lot of hotels, and I think that was the same thing with the the Mohawk Valley and all these houses.
Probably. And the Sagandaga wasn't even there then.
No, no. I mean, just a stream, basically.
Right. And so, it's when you get into the history of this area, I think people tend to forget about what Indians and people from the Mohawk Valley, from the Glover, what's now Gloversville Johnstown area, what the important role they played even up here.
All right.
And actually, the Battle of Saratoga wasn't fought in Saratoga.
No.
It was fought in Stillwater.
Yeah.
So, people think that Saratoga, the city of Saratoga Springs was a battleground back in the Revolutionary War, but it really wasn't. It more or less was famous for its spring,
right.
But that's, and I'm, like I said, I'm fascinated with early 1600s up to the Civil War, not including the Civil War, but that period in between there. So,
well, there was a time when Boston Spa had actually more going for it than Saratoga Springs. They had one of the largest hotels in the Northeast.
Right.
There, and they had tanneries. Also,
they had tanneries, and they bottled water.
Right.
I had a guest on last week, Roy O'Connor, and he was telling me that Boston Spa was the biggest attraction back then, and they had the largest water bottling place in Boston Spa until they started making bottles out in the lake out here. I can't think of the name of the lake just outside of Saratoga. And then they started making bottles, and then Saratoga started bottling their water, and they got to be pretty famous.
Well, I think, the oncoming of the equestrian era of Saratoga, drew people from Boston Spa.
Sure.
Put the spotlight on Saratoga more.
And then they built, and Saratoga had quite a few large hotels. Matter of fact, I think they had the largest hotel in the world at that time. Then they got to be, like you said, with the horse races and the casinos, this became the hot spot for gamblers and that. Mm-hmm. And also bringing in the late 1800s and up until the 50s when, Kefauver had his hearings, a lot of criminal element in Saratoga.
Right.
So that was one area. So what else do you have in the museum thing before
like
we
say,
get...
It's all the way to October. Now, the museum isn't open other than the special events until Memorial Day. It's open Memorial Day to Labor Day, Thursday through Sunday, 12 o'clock to 4. And all this stuff, once again, is on our webpage. Other things are coming up. I say the 28th is the big opening. And then at the Shine Building downtown, which we talked about, which they have a spring exhibit, which will feature artwork and other stuff in the glove industry. There's a student art and essay exhibit, which is at the Fulton Montgomery Chamber of Commerce, which is in downtown Gloversville, and that's from May 1st to June 28th. There's a lecture series, a glove tanning and a retrospective view of the industry and its people. That's given by a University of Albany, a doctorate, and this will be at the Fulton Montgomery Community College, Allen House. I have no idea where the Allen House is, but I'm sure it's on the internet.
You can find it, yeah.
And then July, they have this is kind of interesting, it's a history happy hour at the Stump City Brewing Company, which is just outside of Gloversville. That's on the 25th, 5 to 7. They'll have Samantha Hall Saladino, who is the county historian. She'll be doing a trivia, leather industry trivia. They'll have local craft beers and refreshments. And the last finishes up in October 19th with another lecture series at the Fulton Montgomery Community College Allen House, and that's going to be on the radical union activism in Fulton County tanneries in the 30s. So, you know, once again, go to the webpage, FultonCountyMuseum.com.
Yep. And, you know, it is a nice museum. When Rory was on last week, I had told him that a friend and myself were talking about the Balsam Spa Museum and how that could be expanded because of the history of Balsam Spa. I mean, they know the history and how important it played in the time, you know, before Saratoga. And I said, you know, you should really promote that because I never knew Balsam Spa was such an area back then.
Yeah, I think the Brookside Museum does a lot of outreach, too. They have a lot of outreach programs, a lot of educational programs going on. I'm not overly familiar with the museum, but I think they have a lot of outreach going on.
Yeah, I'd like to get the museum director or the historian involved because areas all over, mostly northern New York State and western New York State, used to help each other out quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And out in the western part of the state, the British had built forts to deal with the Indian population around the Great Lakes areas. And so important people like Sir William Johnson and other, I'm sure, you know, important people in history used to go to these forts with their Indians and take them over. I mean, there were some pretty big forts the French built there to protect that area of going into Canada. And one of the largest wars, I think, out that way was the Pontiac Wars. And I don't know if it was a chief or the name of an Indian tribe that was called the Pontiac War, but they resulted from Native Americans' discontent with British policy following the French and Indian War. And one of the things about the Iroquois, they stopped taking sides during wars.
And they got smart.
Yeah, they got smart. But wasn't the Iroquois one of the most vicious of the Indian tribes?
I don't know. I really don't know that much.
Because they were a lot more, it's said, for diplomatic practices. They used to award gifts to Native Americans for maintaining good relations. And
right, well, a lot of it, you know, they were smart. They needed trade. The British had what they needed, and they had what the British needed as far as skins and trapping areas and stuff. So one hand washed the other for a long time.
Good. Yeah. Well, one of the things Johnson did was negotiated the treaty with Fort Niagara with 2,000 Indians in attendance, primarily Iroquois. Now, even though they stayed out of that Pontiac War, just having 2,000 Indians present, even if they were wimps like on F Troop, the Hakowis, that was, you know, a sign of there could be trouble. So I'm sure the French would want to negotiate, even though the Iroquois weren't that bad.
Right. Well, yeah, a lot depended on, and they used them for scouts, and British, you know, were foreigners here, and it was up to the native people to show them what to do, their different crops. And
sure. Oh, yeah, for food. I mean, they depended on the Indians. And then, like you said, they may not have been directly involved in, let's say, the large wars, but they were scouts and, you know, they pretty good. And they could help the English with letting them know where
Yeah, there, I mean, there was a lot of the animosity was between the French and the British, and depending on what side you were on, you know, if you were on the winning side, you had to choose a side, basically, back then.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's the thing. I mean, and if it ended up when you were on the wrong side, if you're on the Tory side, of course, they got defeated, but they spared, the other side spared no... working along with them. They just took everything.
Oh, yeah, right. Well, as I said, the Mohawks were, at that time, were European, living as Europeans, and they had property. They owned property.
Right.
And it was just, it was all taken away from them.
Taken away from them, yeah.
Well, that's why you got, now you have the St. Regis Reservation up, you know, up north. That's all the leftover from the Revolutionary War, where the Mohawks had to get out of.
Had to get out of there.
Get out and go north.
Now, I think the Mohawks, too, were prominent in our area, down in Fulton County. And
yeah, I believe along the Mohawk River, the Horriesville and all that.
Right, area. Because I know, aren't they the ones that killed the Isaac Jogues and where the Horriesville Shrine is? I know
they could have been, very well could
he
have
was
been.
A Catholic missionary.
Right, there was a couple of them that were martyred there.
And you can still see the steps that the Indians made them run down. They gave them a head start, and they went down the steps. Yeah, the stone steps are still there, but the Indians told a little fib. They didn't give them that big of a head start, and they were killed on those steps. But, you know, I just, even though our area has turned into somewhat in disrepair, major disrepair, I still like to know the history of our area because, like I say, back in the day when we were young, everything was still, you know, going pretty good. And it wasn't until I think we mainly got into high school that the tannery started.
Right.
Going down, and GE had the big layoffs, and most of the people in Fulton Montgomery counties used to work at GE. Canjoharie was another area that was big on the Indians. Nut. Beechnut was in Canjoharie, and then they pulled out. And Canjoharie happened to be the meeting place of the Seven Nations.
Was it really?
Yes. They would either come up or come down from on the Mohawk, and why they chose Canjoharie as a meeting place, but that's where Johnson had to go when they had their... I don't know if it was yearly or every 4 years or whatever, they'd have their big Indian Nation.
There's an interesting museum in Canjoharie. I can't think of the name of it, but it looks like something that should be in downtown Manhattan. It's a beautiful building. It's
really?
Yeah. Arkell Museum, maybe, or something like that. They have artwork, and it's we've had meetings there when I was with the president of the Historical Society. We had meetings there, and it was really impressive that you know, this world-class museum is in Canjoharie. You know?
Yeah, really. Well, I know, like, when I had my one of my businesses had to go down to Fort Plain 2 days a week. I didn't personally. I used to fill in to go down. But there was a lady there that owned a gift shop, and she was always in charge of, they have what they call the Burning of the Valley every year.
Right.
And it's a big, huge thing. She was always in charge of the committee of the to recreate the Burning of the Village. Now, one interesting fact, too, that we're jumping all over the place, and is that Sir William Johnson's Hall in Johnstown is pretty big.
Right.
And you can go, I mean, you can go through the place, and they have the original furniture and
I'm not
things.
Sure how much is original. Yeah, I'm right. Sure some of it is, yeah.
But when they did burn the valley, when the Indians went crazy and they were destroying, they had saved the Johnson Manor. And
I mean, there's an urban legend. I don't know.
There is an urban legend. Why don't you tell it?
About the staircase.
Yeah, yeah.
The original staircase had a bunch of tomahawk, where somebody took a tomahawk and just cut it up.
Right.
And the urban legend is that Joseph Bryant did that, and that was a sign to any Native Americans not to bother
not
the
to
house.
Bother the
but
house.
Then I've heard other
things stories
that contradicted that, so I'm not sure if that's true or not. But the truth is there is a staircase with, and the railing has a bunch of tomahawks.
Right, and that was one marks. Of the buildings that was spared in
right.
the destruction of
There was originally two blockhouses next to each, to the house, the main house. One of them burned down, but I don't think it had anything. It may have burned down, you know, later.
Sure.
They rebuilt that, and they have their office there. But there, one of the one on the left is actually the original blockhouse.
Blockhouse.
And they had a tunnel that went from the house to the blockhouse.
Oh, neat.
In case of any attacks.
Well, one of the things that I always found kind of a little bit crazy was the restaurant down in what is it, Little Falls? I forget the name of the restaurant now. It's an old restaurant, and it supposedly was built by the Indians. And then there was a cave that the Indians lived in the back, and there was a cave in, and all the Indians died. You know which one I'm talking about?
Beardsley Manor.
Beardsley Manor. And now the Indians are supposed to haunt the...
Right.
We've
eaten there downstairs where the dungeon was.
Right.
It's a nice place. It's interesting. Actually, one of the paranormal shows, like Ghost Hunters or somebody,
right.
actually did that quite a few years ago.
Stayed overnight.
Yeah, or whatever they do there.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's supposed to be haunted. They got pictures of you know, supposedly spirits. They were taken.
Right.
And they're on the wall down there.
And they say if the night is quiet and the wind is still, you can hear Native Americans having a war dance in the back of the property there. But I'm sure that's...
the jukebox from the local bar.
Probably. That's right. That's probably what it is. But, I mean, here again, that area is close by to a river.
Right.
And that's where you would get... a lot of population growth. Now, some people think that all Indians got together like blood brothers, but that's really not the case.
No, they were, a lot of them were enemies. That's what the Confederation, I can't remember what the name of the Native American was, but he drew them all together, and you know, all this inner fighting and was not doing anybody any good, and he organized it. And
right. Because they would take, of course, I mean, you can get the gist from this from watching cowboy movies on TV. but they took a lot of women, of course, to be slaves or integrate into their tribe. But they also took men as slaves.
Mm-hmm.
And they were the slaves for the tribe that beat them.
Right.
And that I find that interesting.
They're a matriarchic, meaning that if you married, if the Native American man married into the family, he would marry into the woman's family.
Oh, really?
That was more important. The woman's family, you know, now it's kind of the opposite, but
right.
And that's the way it was. The man would more or less take the name of the woman's tribe,
right.
or clan, more like a clan. It was just a matriarch.
And she would probably be not the boss of the Indian, but the boss of the teepee, probably. I mean,
the longhouse.
Of the longhouse. Oh, they didn't live in teepees?
No, teepees are Plains Indians.
Oh, okay.
This was longhouses, and some of them had other type of a rounder type of building. I can't remember the name of it, but locally it was a longhouse. And some of them were like 80 feet long, maybe 40 feet wide, and multiple families would live in them. And there were no windows.
Oh,
they
wow.
had holes in the ceiling where they had their campfires, so it was smoky, dark, and they lived on like almost bunk beds.
Wow.
It was
yeah, good. That's interesting.
And they usually had a stockade around it, too, much as what you see in the Western movies.
Right.
You know, they had a stockade to protect themselves.
That,
and it was usually on a high ground, too, where they could see.
So they could see.
The high ground is always important in any kind of military engagement.
Oh, most definitely. I mean, high ground was hard to take over.
Right.
because it's easier shooting an arrow downhill than it is shooting an arrow uphill. But no, I mean, you had better vision, and it's, I mean, you can see other Indians climbing the hill to get to you.
And, yeah, I think on Route 5, there's another shrine, and I believe there are markings where a stockade used to be or something like that.
Really?
Yeah. That used to be another Catholic shrine, I believe, at one time.
Well, you know, as I said, Saratoga Springs, in our area, and I call it our area, even though I live in Saratoga now, but we're kind of joined because our area down west of us really did help this eastern part of the state as well as the northern part. I mean, especially more so doing trade before the Revolutionary War, but during the Revolutionary War, pretty much saving this area from Canada or from the British. We probably would be Canadians now, I think, right. if they didn't win the battles that they did. And I know some of the people that, I mean, Johnson was wounded at the Battle of Lake George.
Mm-hmm.
So he wasn't too far away from, well, back then it was probably quite a ways away from Saratoga Springs, but Saratoga was known to be the Great Healing Springs. They called it the Medicine Spring of the Great Spirit, because so many people that, and who knows what their ailment was, but when they drank the water, they felt better. The bubbles got to them, or whatever the heck it is, what it was back then. But General Schuyler, Governor George Clinton, who is no relation to Bill Clinton, and Alexander Hamilton, along with George Washington, visited High Rock Spring.
Mm-hmm.
When they came through to check the battlegrounds and the lands and that, they all stopped at the springs because it had such a reputation. But I was interested also in, when I was reading the book, how not just the Indian tribes in Iroquois Nation, but even out in the West and mid-central parts of the country, the Indians really didn't get along with other tribes.
No.
I mean, and many of the tribes were cannibalistic, and actually were paid by the British for taking scalps of other people. And so I found that interesting also. But we have a couple minutes to fill up, and then Big John's here, and I'm going to go over with him some of the things that we found out. So, Mark, I appreciate you being here. And we have anything you want to finish up with?
No, just I can say the Fulton County Museum, FultonCountyMuseum.com, if you want to see what's going on. And there are other things. If you're going to that area, you can also see the Sir William Johnson Manor and some other sites.
Okay. Well, appreciate you being here. I'm going to put a little music on and go over a couple things with John, and then we will, and then he'll be back with the Polish Magic Show. And it's the fastest 3 hours in radio. So glad you were with us this week, and we'll be back next week with a great guest. So have a good one.